Hello, this is Tamika Faison, your host for Therapy Entrepreneurs and Leaders of Color, a podcast dedicated to supporting and showcasing therapy entrepreneurs and leaders of color around the world. Our guest today is Dr. Awama, a famous occupational therapy practitioner, scholar, educator, all the things, as I say sometimes. Dr. Awama is widely recognized for having developed the Kalama, the first substantial model of practice in the rehabilitation sciences developed outside the English-speaking world. The Kalama model is now taught in over 600 health profession education programs internationally and used in practice across six continents. He has emerged as a very important and progressive thinker in the fields of occupational therapy and rehabilitation sciences worldwide. Dr. Awama draws on his rich experiences of acculturating into Eastern and Western social spheres of experience to drive his profound and critical perspectives on culture and its intersections with theory and practice in the rehabilitation sciences. He most recently was the Dean of the School of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences and Professor in the Department of Occupational Therapy at MGH Institute of Health Professions. Dr. Awama was an adjunct professor in the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Toronto and holds similar adjunct professional appointments at six universities in Canada, the United Kingdom, Australia, and Asia. This is amazing. The Kalama model, Culturally Relevant Occupational Therapy, was published in 2006, and he has given over 300 invited lectures. I'm sure that number is higher now. I said earlier when we were talking before the podcast, over 40 keynotes, and he said it's 90 now. So over 90 keynotes. He has more than 25 publications in both English and Japanese in professional journals. Dr. Awama is currently a full professor in the Duke Occupational Therapy Doctorate Program. I am very honored to work alongside him. We have a few teams that we work together on, and it's just been a pleasure to get to know you, Dr. Awama, because, you know, I heard of the Kalama model, but I didn't really know Dr. Awama, actually, like, before you came to Duke. I was like, who is this? But I heard of the Kalama model, and then I started learning more about you. Like, there's so much to you. And so I know we're not going to be able to cover all of it during this podcast, and that bio was very brief in comparison to what I could have said about you. But can we just start with you? Well, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm just so thrilled to be your guest.
I appreciate it. I appreciate it. And if you could just start with telling us about how did you get into occupational therapy?
Well, it's a long story, but I think that it's an interesting one. I want to just preface everything by saying that I was born and raised in Japan, and it was in the 1970s when I was just entering high school that my family emigrated to Vancouver, Canada, on the West Coast. So that's just a little bit north of Seattle. And that's where I did most of my tertiary education. And the first degree that I went to pursue, a bachelor's degree, was, at the time it was called human performance, but I think people today would call it exercise sciences or kinesiology. And so when I graduated, the natural progression from there was to go into physical therapy. In Canada, it's called physiotherapy. And I was really interested in sports physiotherapy. And so I was very fortunate to have spent some time as an athletic trainer for the Canadian national men's and women's basketball teams, as well as the national volleyball teams, and also did some work with professional teams, namely ice hockey, which is really big in Canada. But it was during, so I then pursued physical therapy. And as I was actually in a clinical rotation, I looked at across the gymnasium floor, a couple of OTs that were working. They were working with a person who had suffered a stroke, and they were a married couple from the United States, specifically from California. And so as I was next to a patient, a physical therapy patient, counting repetitions of leg extensions, and probably, at the time I was bored out of my mind, and I would watch these OTs across the gymnasium floor, and they were doing something different with that client every day. And so I got talking to them, and they started telling me about occupational therapy. And in fact, they invited me to come and live in the basement of their home while I was doing my placement. Now, at the time, I didn't know how important this was, but they had both graduated from the University of Southern California, and their teachers were people like Mary Riley and Rude and Jean Ayers and so on and so forth. Now, those names mean something to me today now, but at the time, I didn't realize, but their classmate was Gary Kielhoff. So they kind of indoctrinated me into occupational therapy and all of its possibilities. And so what I did was I quit the path that I was on to become a physical therapist to then study occupational therapy, which I did at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. And since then, I've worked at seven universities in four different countries. I started working in practice in return to work occupational therapy and ergonomics. And from there, I found myself going into the classroom. The person who gave me my first teaching job was a fellow named Dr. Charles Christensen, who was my boss up in that program in Canada. So I had some really good mentors. And along the way. And so that's how I discovered occupational therapy. And I've discovered that this is just the best health profession in the world. And I have absolutely no regrets about that decision that I made.
Oh, that's a fascinating story. So you actually lived with some OTs, and then you had these, what would we call them, rock star OTs in the profession, and you didn't even realize that you were being mentored by
these.
Oh, wow. Okay, so you decided to become an OT, you get a job, Charles Christensen offers you your first teaching job. How do you go from being a clinician, then an educator, to a leader who is developing a model that goes, you know, international, a leader who becomes a dean? What was that path like? Was that intentional, or did it just kind of happen? Can you talk more about that?
No, it was not intentional at all. But it just happened to be that in clinical practice, I was doing some innovative things. In fact, I started one of the first freestanding work hardening and work capacity evaluation programs in Canada. And what we were doing was considered to be so new that over at the university, Dr. Christensen recognized that and wanted to bring that into their classrooms. So I was working as a clinician, and then a couple of days a week, I'd then go over to the university and teach these classes in vocational rehab and ergonomics. And so it was my experience in the classroom in teaching that I discovered that I kind of liked it, and everybody told me I had a good knack of doing that. And I think that I just found myself naturally progressing into these leadership positions. And so from there, I had an opportunity to return back to my native Japan to teach OT. One of the first OT programs. When I went to Japan, there were 45 OT programs. And when I left 7 years later, there were about 160. And so for me, it was a profound cultural experience because I had already acculturated into North American life. And now I was back in my native Japan. And although I could speak the language, culturally and in terms of my world views, they were very Western, very North American. And it's during that rich experience that I realized that occupational therapy is Western centric, predominantly reflecting affluent life, a white person's experience of life. And all of this just did not fit. Occupational therapy just did not fit into Japanese daily life. And so it's through those conundrums, the frustrations of trying to force Western cultural norms into Japanese society that I found myself then saying, let's just build a new model from scratch. And that's what happened. And at the time, I thought that this model would be only good for Japanese OTs. But because it's based on a metaphor of a river to depict a person's life journey, the metaphor, the model, the Kawa model, gained the attraction of people all over the world. And so that's where I think that that transition took off from where I was before, with some leadership experience, to then now having my work go ahead of me and pull me into a much greater leadership role. And so I would have to say that, yeah, it's the cultural experiences, it's the need or drive to want to do something good and helpful for others. And to also maybe have a measure of ignorance mixed together with courage to be able to step forward and to fight for your ideas, in this case, my ideas, and what I wanted to do. Because I'll tell you 100 stories of the kind of opposition that I met in terms of trying to bring theoretical material and core concepts built outside of the Western world into these other places.
Yeah, I want to get into that. But before we do that, I do have a question about you going into these leadership roles. I said you had rock stars earlier. Can we change that to R&B stars? Because we like R&B music. Sure. I have this thing about R&B music, y'all.
Oh, man, it's the best.
Let's switch up the genres of stars. So were those folks involved with you as you were climbing the ladder, so to speak, to, you know, go into to create this model and to grow it internationally, but to also become a dean in academia? Did you have someone to help you as you were growing, especially considering that you had opposition that we're going to talk about in a few minutes?
Yeah, I think that probably what maybe the most important factor was my experience of being an immigrant and making the transition from Japan into Canadian life at an impressionable age of, you know, being an adolescent going into high school. And I think that that's where I met the greatest degree of adversity, of not fitting in, of being part of a minority, trying to ask someone that I like to go on a date and then just being rejected because of the color of my skin. It's through those kinds of adverse experiences that really, I think, were the building blocks that really powered me through later on. I had really good role models around me. I had two older brothers, and of course, people like Dr. Christensen and others that gave me examples of what leadership looks like, and coupled together with this drive to overcome barriers. That's probably what it was.
Awesome. So were there any, you said you had two older brothers, was there anyone in OT that you felt like had a shared lived experience related to, to some of the challenges that you were dealing with that helped you? That's one of the things we talk about sometimes on this podcast, is that as people are going into leadership, they're looking for people who have similar experiences that can mentor them. Did you have that?
I'm searching my mind right now, and what I'm experiencing is some of the emotions that I felt back then, and that was one of loneliness. Mm. Look at American occupational therapy. How many leaders that are of Japanese American heritage do you see in leadership positions? In prominent positions where change can be brought up to the profession to grow it. I can't think of any. I can think of some historically, certainly not to the grandeur of the people that we consider to be leaders in our profession today, thought leaders, people developing models and theory and so on. They're all predominantly white.
Right, and, yeah.
Yeah.
And I know that you you give back to other people who have shared lived experience. And Actually, I remember someone on our podcast previously mentioning how you were there for them. Drawing a blank on his name. I think it was Bill Wong. No. Yeah, Bill Wong, I mentioned. And so I'm glad that you can be available to other people. But yeah, there's so many people of color, people from underrepresented groups who look for those role models, for those mentors. And unfortunately, particularly in the U.S., that we don't have as many as we should. Okay, so let's talk about some of that opposition.
Yeah.
Well, can you give some examples of what types of challenges you experienced?
Sure. And I have to say that my earlier work, academic work, really brought a critical social science approach to things. And so I started off by criticizing occupational therapy as a Western-centric construction. In fact, my PhD thesis that I did in Japan in the field of sociology was titled it's about the social construction of occupational therapy in Japan, because occupational therapy was imported into Japan from the United States. And so the nature of my work was really unwelcome at a time when I believe that our profession of occupational therapy was still intellectually, academically juvenile. You know, we were all like, everybody was just following the mantra of all of these great models that were made in North America. You know, the model of human occupation, the Canadian model of occupational performance, you know, the PEO and so on and so forth. So when somebody like me comes along and says, hey, wait a minute, you know, our models and our main ideas in OT are very individual centric and places a lot of emphasis on a person's ability to do and to act on the world. And here I had come from a very different experience in Japan, where people are collectively oriented. They see themselves as part of groups, as embedded with each other, you know, and to say, we need to evolve our ideas in OT, but I want to, you know, basically say, in order to do that, sometimes we have to take things apart. And that's what I proceeded to do. And that's when the opposition reared its ugly head. And some examples, for example, is not having your papers published in peer-reviewed journals. I don't want to name names, but I'll just say the prominent journals, the reviewers that would review these submitted articles put up the wall. And in some cases, I've had chapters for prominent textbooks that were accepted, but behind the scenes, you know, another OT leader, probably somebody that I looked up to, who, you know, authored another model, basically shut it down and said, you cannot publish Iwama's chapter in this textbook. And when people hold that kind of influence, man, oh man, it's a war. It's a battle. And there are very, very lonely times, because the very people that you look up to, the theorists, the people that are at the forefront of creating ideas in OT, are turning around and basically saying, we reject you and we don't want you in our group. We don't, you know, that's probably something that your podcast listeners are probably, you know, not used to hearing, but we have a ways to go as a profession. And if we're really serious about evolving our profession in a direction that is much more equitable, inclusive, and honors the diversity, we've got to make some changes. And there's a lot of serious looking in the mirror that our profession needs to do.
I agree. And I mean, that just hurt, like, hearing you, when the way you summarize that you have people that you look up to that basically reject you. Yeah. And not only do you look up to them, everybody else is looking up to those same people. So it hurts. I mean, I think that's just a way to describe it. It's lonely and it's hurtful. And you talked a little bit about mentors helping you through that. what advice would you give? Like, what things were most helpful, and what advice would you give to others who may be experiencing this rejection, which, you know, maybe due to just bias? And
well, one piece of advice, and that's one that I have always kept with me for decades. I was told once to surround yourself with good people. And I think that that's really important, especially for people like me of color, people that can relate to your life experiences, that come from a similar place, socially, culturally, people that you can trust, that when you are being rejected by the big stars in OT, that you've got a group of people that understand your pain, understand you know, what is happening, and also in their own little way, do what they can to support you. So I think that that maybe that's been one of the most important factors behind my success, is that it's not just the solitary game of just looking within yourself and, you know, being courageous and strong by yourself and doing things by yourself. Not at all. You're actually enabled to do those things because of the people around you, whether they give you the confidence, a pat on the back, or help to be around when you're licking your wounds. I think that that's really important. And if you are a person in a prominent leadership position, be conscious of that and honor your people by recognizing when there are colleagues that are trying to do the right thing, to do good work, to get ahead, is to then reach down and give them a hand. Recognize what difficulties and what adversity they're up against. And you can relate to it because you've experienced it and you've survived it yourself.
Yeah, so, that's good advice. Good advice. I was listening to a podcast. I can't remember the name of the person who was speaking, but she talked about the importance of speaking people's name in a room. If you have power and you know what other people are experiencing, speak their names and advocate for them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just so powerful. And I'm very conscious of the fact that I've enjoyed some respect and prominence from people in different parts of the world. And I am conscious of the kind of influence that I have and the power of my voice. And so I go out of my way at conferences, international conferences, to talk to people like students and others, and to be able to not patronize them or talk down to them, but to take interest in where they are and where they're going, and to be able to say their name and be able to validate their existence and the path that they're on.
And I know this is, I know the for a fact that this is true, because we attended a conference together and you were the keynote. And I'm trying to think of the next genre of music that I want to say that you are star. We used rock star, we used R&B star. What other genre of music do you like?
Well, I like Brazilian bossa nova.
Okay, Brazilian bossa nova star. You had a line. I mean, you had a long line of people waiting to talk to you, and you could have easily brushed them all, you know, left. But I watched you, and I watched you talk to every single person that was in line, and not a brief conversation. Like, I saw you having deep conversations with students, with people with different, you know, different levels of authority, so to speak. I can't think of a better way to describe it, but yeah. I just watched how you interacted with everyone, and it was really impressive. Wow, he is what did you say, Brazilian?
Bossa Nova.
There's Brazilian Bossa Nova. Sorry, all these people gathered around him and waiting to talk to him, and so patiently you took the time and got to know them, listen to them, and have conversation with them. So
yeah, well, you know, and I just think back to when I was a student, and if, you know, some prominent leader took the time to chat with me and to get to know me and know something personal about me, that's, I just know that that's really powerful. And, you know, what comes with leadership and with respect and prominence is a responsibility. And you never, ever forget where you've come from. And you gather good karma. That's the other piece of advice I have for people, is be a karma hog, is go and do good. Like, you know, do the most good. And you're going to die one day with a smile on your face. You may not be rich, but you'll die with a smile on your face.
Yeah, it's another form of wealth, you know. It's a different form of wealth. It's happiness and doing good. And it, like you said, it comes back. So be a karma hog. We got some things to trademark. Brazilian Bossa Nova, star, and karma hog. Okay. Right on. Yeah. So what's next for you? You've done so much already and still doing a lot, but what's next for you and how can we support you in that?
Well, you know, I joke and tell people, as you know, Tomiko, when we're talking as a faculty, that I call myself a digital Neanderthal, meaning that, you know, I mean, in the past, I've been really active on Facebook and not so much recently, but I had an experience that kind of changed my life recently. And that is that I was giving a virtual keynote address in Spain to the OTs of Spain. And so I spoke for about 45 minutes. And people wanted, of course, they wanted me to talk about the Kawa model a bit, which I did. And then afterwards, I asked the hosts, I said, how many people attended this conference in person? And they said, oh, there were about 250. And I thought, wow, that's a pretty good gathering.
Yeah.
And then they said, however, there were close to 400 OTs, many of them students, in various countries in South America. These are folks that don't have the money to even buy textbooks or to let alone get on a plane and get to and pay conference registration fees to go and hear somebody speak, for their lecture. And I just had this idea and I thought, well, you know, the Kawa model has spread all over the world and I get correspondence every week from all over, people asking me simple questions about this and that. And I thought, well, why don't I start a YouTube channel where on a weekly basis, I can just give instruction freely and, you know, kind of a place where anybody can go, and I want to do this in various languages, of course, Spanish as well, but to have a place where if they want to know about the Kawa model or anything that I have worked on, that I can give it to them. And all they need is a internet connection to be able to get it. So that's my next thing. And I'm planning for that now. And I think that people can really help out by not just promoting that channel when it does happen, but also to participate and be part of the conversations. The one thing about the Kawa model that is really that I'm proud of is that it resonates with people all over the world, of people of different cultures, of different races. It's very inclusive in that regard. And so that's what I would ask for, is for people to help me promote it and to participate.
That's awesome. So when you get the channel, what I'll do is go back and edit the show notes to have a link to the YouTube channel. So you all subscribe to the channel and participate. So this is exciting. And yeah. You know, this is, you're an influencer, so we can add another, we'll be able to add another title. You'll be an influencer. I don't know if you saw, Michael, that I posted in our faculty chat this morning, I posted a link to an episode on the Today Show where Duke was on the Today Show because of a class on influencing. So there is a class that is being taught at Duke University on how to be an influencer and how to, you know, it's a business, right? It generates revenue and you provide a service, and it's a class that's offered that I guess is becoming fairly popular at Duke, but also at other universities, is that this is a reality that we live in now, a society that social media the thing, and it has an impact, and we can use it, you know, instead of just resisting it, as some people do. You know, there's pros and cons, I think, to everything, but it's how you use it. So I think using a YouTube channel to share information and invite people to participate in conversation about the Kawa model is using social media for good.
Yeah, well, let me just say that I'll just point out one mistake, Tomiko, and that is that that when the Today Show featured Duke, they should have had you on the
Well, that's why Gary said, and I was like, I'm on the struggle bus. I do these videos. I misspell words. I do it like my pictures don't look right for Instagram and Facebook, but I feel like I feel good about LinkedIn. So that's funny, but I still got a long ways to go. Maybe we'll help each other. You help me with YouTube, and I'll help you with LinkedIn when we get it figured out.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, it's a deal. And I think we've got many people witnessing this, so we're going to do it.
Right, we'll hold each other accountable. All right, so any last words of wisdom that you want to leave for the audience as we wrap up the show?
Yeah, and because we're talking about entrepreneurship and leadership, I guess what I want to say is that everything that you've experienced in your life, the highs and the lows, the good, the bad, and the ugly, all of it, all of these experiences are preparing you for your next step. And so take heart in the battles that you've fought, even the ones that you've lost, because they are feeding your soul and preparing you for the next step. And so that's just one pearl of wisdom. The other is just a wish for everybody that I would like your river to continue to flow powerfully and beautifully, and just keep going. Be optimistic. There is your river is flowing to a better place just around the corner.
I love it. I love it. Wise words from a very wise person. Thank you. Thank you, Michael, for being on the show. Dr. Nwama, like I said, what is it, Botswana? I'm going to say it wrong. I'm going to mess it up. Star. What's the music again?
Oh, Bossa Nova. Yeah. That's, yeah. And I mentioned, you know, those students from South America, right? Well, Bossa Nova comes from one of the South American countries, from Brazil.
Okay. I'm going to have to listen to that. I appreciate you. I appreciate you being on the show. I appreciate you being a leader in our profession. I'm glad that we've gotten to know each other a bit better since you joined the Duke OTD faculty. And I'm excited about all what you're going to continue, you know, all what you're doing and going to continue to do. Especially looking forward to the YouTube channel. And you all make sure you support and follow. And don't forget to follow us. Thank you for listening. That's our show.